Let me remind you, we've scheduled our second exam next Monday, and we'll do a full review on Friday. I'll do as we did the last time. I'll try to give a quick summary of the material we've covered, and then we'll work our way through a practice exam that should be pretty close to the actual exam you would take on Monday. But we'll do that review on Friday. Today, the intent of today's lecture is actually to do a bit of review as well. But what I'm going to do is place the things we've learned about the vector space Rn, place it in a more general context, so you see why we spent so much time talking about subspaces and bases, etc., is because now we have a platform where that apparatus becomes useful. And in fact, what we need is actually the language of linear algebra to talk about linear algebra as it's going to be used in applications beyond this course. So let me remind you quickly what we did on Monday. Let's see if I can grab that a little better. Okay, so what I did on Monday is I introduced the abstract notion of an abstract or general vector space, where now our vector space is not necessarily an ordered list of numbers. Rather, it's some abstract set. It could be vibrations, it could be the states of an elementary particle. There's many situations that we're going to now be able to handle using the language we've developed for Rn. What we need is a set V, and on that set we need some notion of scalar multiplication, some way to take elements of the set and multiply them by a number to produce a new element of the set, and we need some way of adding them together. And surprisingly, maybe it's not a surprise because it's the first time you've seen it, but it is to me kind of surprising that just setting up an abstract set and giving two functions on that set gives us the whole structure of linear algebra. So we've been developing that piecemeal throughout the semester, but the point now is that we these eight identities are also satisfied once we know how to add elements of our set, and once we know how to do scalar multiplication. If these properties hold, then in effect, our set V is going to behave exactly like our calculable vector space Rn. And in fact, that's the whole purpose of this course, is to bring abstract vector spaces into a calculable setting. So what we're going to do today is I'm going to step through the definitions we use for Rn, but I'm going to place them in the context of a more general vector space. And then as I move through these definitions, partially to prepare you for the exam on Monday, but also to show you why you're actually taking this course. And finally, it's sort of sad that it's actually at this point in the course that we're actually able to explain what linear algebra is good for. Okay, so now let me run quickly through the examples of vector spaces that abstract vector spaces that I covered on Monday. First of all, a familiar vector space Rn that consists of ordered lists of numbers. Naturally, once we define the usual notions of scalar multiplication and vector addition for ordered lists of numbers, all eight of these preceding properties, they hold automatically. So I'm flipping around here. A second example was, well, once we discuss Rn, then we talked about subspaces of Rn. In fact, subspaces of Rn are another example of an abstract vector space, because you have closure under scalar multiplication and vector addition, you can, just by restricting to the vectors that live inside this subset, you get maps that take you from numbers and elements of the subset back to your elements of your subset, or pairs of elements inside a subspace mapped you back to another element inside the subspace. And so you get well-defined notions of scalar multiplication and vector addition when you restrict the vectors to live inside this subspace. And that gives the subspace the structure of a general vector space. Here's a more abstract example that it's actually going to be important in today's lecture. Most of the examples of an abstract vector space I give today are going to be function spaces. But in fact, anytime you have a function taking values in a vector space, doesn't even have to be R. You could have like the electromagnetic field where you have every point in space taking a value in a particular direction, you know, the direction that the electric field is setting, or the gravitational field. Basically, anytime you have a function space, it's going to have well-defined operations of scalar multiplication and vector addition, except that rather than acting on ordered lists of numbers, now scalar multiplication is changing a function, or adding two functions produces another function. And so we can now view functions on the real line, or effectively anything. We really only need to have the values of the function be in some vector space, so we can do these additions and scalar multiplication. As long as we have that, we have another vector space, and so something that's amenable to our linear algebraic techniques. Then I talked about the vibrational modes of a string. That's also non-mathematical, it's maybe physical. I mean, what I'm talking about is the vibrating spring in reality, not the mathematical model that we describe it, but it's still an abstract vector space. And polynomials are yet another example of a vector space. Okay, so now the point of this is that we focused on Rn because, in fact, the purpose of Rn is it gives us the calculational platform by which we can study all these more general examples of a vector space. So to prepare for that, what I want to do is just step through the definitions that we know concerning the vector space Rn, and now just change Rn to V, and I'll restate the definitions. They're essentially the same. For example, if you have an abstract vector space and you have a subset of it, that's going to be, if it's closed under scalar multiplication and vector addition, then we'll continue to call it a subspace. Well, the original definitions where you take a number and an element of your set, sorry, there's some typos here, and a vector that lives inside your subset, if that scalar multiple remains inside that subset, then it's closed under scalar multiplication. And similarly, if you start off with two vectors living in this subset, an abstract set V, but when you add them together using the rules for addition in V, and you stay inside that set, well, that's closure under vector addition. And we say that any subspace that's closed under both these operations is a subspace. Similarly, we can take a set of objects sitting inside this set. We have a way of scalar multiplying them. We have a way of adding them. And so we have a way of taking linear combinations of these guys. So we can take linear combinations of functions if you like. And in fact, you do that all the time. It's just you've never thought of it as a linear algebraic action. But if we can take linear combinations of elements of this set, then we can form general linear combinations and in fact create an entire subspace. Whatever this function space is, if we have a list of elements in it, we can take all possible linear combinations of them, and that will create a subspace of this abstract vector space. Well, and then for ordered lists of numbers, we had a notion of linear independence. That was if we had a list of ordered list of numbers, and the only way we can get a linear combination of them to equal the zero vector would be by taking all the coefficients separately equal to zero. Well, if this condition holds, we say that the vectors that we started off with are linearly independent. And all I'm doing in this definition is replacing Rn by this general vector space V. This is exactly the same definition. It's just the arena in which we're carrying out these operations has changed. We're now doing it in an abstract vector space rather than in Rn. And we still have a notion of a basis. A basis for a subspace in Rn was a set of linearly independent vectors that was capable of generating the entire vector space. And that's exactly the definition we'll use in this more general context. What we require to have a basis for an abstract subspace of a general vector space is, well, we need to be able to take linear combinations of these generating vectors and thereby create the entire vector space. And secondly, we need these guys to be linearly independent because the main utility of a basis is to provide coordinates. And in the current context, that's even more important. Where our vector space is a solution set of differential equations, or it's states of a hydrogen atom, the vibrations of an oscillating spring, I can describe those objects, but you don't have a clue as to how to calculate with them until you can actually bring them into a setting where numbers can work. And that's exactly what this notion of basis does for it. I introduced it as a way of coordinatizing subspaces, saying, for example, if I had a three-dimensional subspace of a 10-dimensional space, I don't want to use 10 parameters to describe the elements of that three-dimensional space. So we introduced this concept of basis as a way of giving better coordinates for the elements that actually live in a smaller dimensional subspace of a larger vector space. In the current context, though, it's even more important because when you have an abstract vector space, you don't have any way of attaching numbers to it at all until you actually furnish it with a basis. But our principal results concerning bases for Rn are going to carry over until bases for these abstract vector spaces. So in particular, every vector space, whether it's Rn or more general vector space, it does have a basis. This theorem actually doesn't rely so much on linear algebra, but rather on abstract set theory. It's basically reducible to the axiom of choice in set theory. But the other thing is that common thing that carries over into our more now general setting is that every basis for a vector space has the same number of vectors. In the context of Rn, the number of basis vectors, we use that to ascribe a dimension to our subspace. Well, now if every basis for a general vector space always has the same number of vectors, now we can ascribe a notion of dimension to even these abstract vector spaces. It's the number of elements you need in order to reach every point in that space and to provide you with good coordinates. All right, so let me give you example of how we'll use bases in a more general vector space. Basically, it has to do with what I was stressing before, the ability to use bases to coordinatize a subspace. But let me recall that procedure. Only now, instead of saying subspace, I'll just talk about a general vector space. So suppose V is a general vector space. It could be a subspace of Rn, but now we have more examples of these general vector spaces. And what I want, if B1 through Bn is the basis for that, what that means is, first of all, that every element of the set can be written using a linear combination of these given list of elements of B. And moreover, if it's a basis, then these numbers, these multipliers, C1 through Cn, they're all numbers. And in fact, since I have an ordered list of vectors here, I'm going to get an ordered list of coefficients. Then I can now consolidate into an ordered list of n numbers, and so an element of Rn. So what this is doing for us is it's taking these abstract vectors, think of it as a function or a vibration, and it's giving you explicit numerical coordinates for that. But the way you go from abstract vectors to concrete coordinates, though, that You need this basis in order to get that process started. All right, so let me show you how you've seen bases before, but it was never explained to you in the language of linear algebra. For example, in calculus 2, you learn that every function that you can differentiate repeatedly on the real line, it always has a unique Taylor expansion. It looks like this. The value of function at a point x is its value at an expansion point x0. Its derivative evaluated at that point times the displacement from the expansion point. And similar terms, here's the generic term. Oops, and this should have been raised to the power n. And in calculus 2, this is introduced as a way of if you want to approximate a function, you can just truncate this infinite expansion at a finite point, and then you get a polynomial that approximates some otherwise more complicated function. But what I want to point out here is, I'm hoping that you recall this theorem, but what I want to point out is that now you can understand this situation as saying that the functions on the real line that you can differentiate, they form a vector space with the usual notions of scalar multiplication. The scalar multiple of a function by a number lambda is the new function whose value at the point x is lambda times the value of the function of fx. So this is how we take a number and a function, and we get a new function. And similarly, we have two functions, we can add them. We create a new function whose value at x is the sum of the values of f and g. So these two operations are easy to define, give the space of functions the structure of a vector space. And here what I'm saying is that this Taylor expansion, what it amounts to is expressing an arbitrary function as a linear combination of a given list of functions. And in fact, the Taylor expansion is unique. Once you have the function, these coefficients, it's just a number, right? It's f evaluated at a particular point. So even though you may have to use your calculator to get a value for this thing, this is just a number, this is just a number, this is just a number as well. And what they're doing is they're multiplying particular functions. This first number is just multiplying the function whose constant value is equal to 1. The second number is multiplying the function whose value is x minus x naught. So here's our, insert the one here. Those are your basis vectors here and here. And then these are your coefficients. And so, so the Taylor theorem is just a theorem that tells you that the vector space of differentiable functions has a natural basis. And in fact, it has many bases because you can choose your expansion point at will. You can choose to expand around the origin, x equals 0. You can expand around x equals 1. So in fact, this not only shows you that you have a natural basis for functions that you can differentiate, but in fact, you have many, many choices of bases as well. And that was part of the point of talking about subspaces as well, is the fact that we have many bases in general. What you want is a good basis that makes things easier for you rather than more complicated. Think of this as just finding a good basis is just equivalent to finding a good set of coordinates. What is a good set of coordinates depends on the sort of problem you're looking at. If you're working on a sphere, I'm working outside the context of linear algebra. But if you're working on a sphere, you want to use spherical coordinates. If you're working in a plane, you'll want to use Cartesian coordinates. Well, now in this more general context, when we're working with functions, it might be best to simplify matters is to choose a nice basis of functions so that a problem that we're looking at becomes a little bit easier. And then you can understand this Taylor expansion as saying, well, we're going to look at general functions on the real line, but what we're interested in is the behavior of functions near a particular point x0. Then it makes sense to look at these functions and think of them in coordinates in which the behavior near the point x zero becomes increasingly important. And so you're able to focus on a particular aspect of the function by choosing a nice basis for this. Now this this idea is not just limited to Taylor expansions. If you do circuit theory and you want to maybe you have a signal, electronic signal fluctuating through a circuit. Well, maybe you even have it as in a laboratory. You hook your circuit up to an oscilloscope to see the changing surface. Well, typically the way electrical engineer will analyze such a situation is by doing what's called a Fourier expansion, where instead of you can actually think of the oscillations of that circuit as forming a vector space. And the way you get a basis for that is by enumerating the natural vibrational modes. Yeah, you can think of it as having a simple sine function or maybe a harmonic associated with that simple sine function. You think of this as the signal you see on your oscilloscope. What you can do is you can take one of your functions and you can expand it, for example, Cn cosine nx. You can expand it in terms of these functions that naturally oscillate. And when you do that, what that is called is a Fourier expansion, and it's used to analyze the signals in maybe a musical signal or other electronic signals used to analyze in terms of simpler base vibrations, so to speak. But what it is a bunch of coefficients times particular functions. And there again, you're seeing the use of a basis, this time not simple powers of x minus x naught. Now what we're using as a basis for this space of functions is a bunch of trigonometric functions, but they'll still play the same role linear algebraically. They allow us to express an arbitrary function as a linear combination of a given list of functions. And then what the engineers do is they regard these numbers here as the coordinates that will actually reproduce a given signal. Okay, so all this apparatus that we've been developing, it really comes into fruition when we start looking at vector spaces other than Rn. Yet, Rn remains the calculational platform that we strive to bring in a more general vector space, such as a space of function. We try to bring it into that calculable arena. Okay, and that's what bases do for us. Bases allow us, once we've got a basis identified, then we can expand every function in terms of them, and we can use the coefficients of those expansions to get a good numerical handle on the more abstract object we're dealing with. All right, yeah.
So are we going to decide what we want to use as our basis?
And in fact, what you'll find in your applications is your first problem, and actually the hardest problem that you have at all in your analysis, is to find that basis. So for example, when you solve a second order linear differential equation, y double prime plus p of x y prime plus q of x y is equal to zero. So if you've had math 2233, the whole second half of the course is dealing with differential equations like this. And what you know about from math 2233 is that the solution set of this, well, the general solution is always expressed as a linear combination of two solutions that satisfy the Wronskian condition. But what is this really saying? It's saying that the solutions of this are functions. In fact, we're looking at a subspace of the functions. We want the functions that actually satisfy this differential equation. So we get a subspace of the space of functions, but that's still a vector space. And here we're the statement that the solution must be this form is equivalent to saying that solutions of a linear differential equation, a second order linear differential equation, are always linear combinations of two basic solutions. And these are your so-called fundamental solutions, but what they are basis for the solution set. And the statement that every solution of this has this form is really equivalent to the linear algebraic statement that your two solutions are actually sufficient to generate every solution. But to your question, the hard part about solving a differential equation is finding those two solutions. Yeah, so effectively, all I'm really telling you is that in a more general context where you have a more abstract vector space, is that, yeah, you need a basis to get started. But that's the first major problem that you're going to run into. But once you have that, now, once you have your solutions, is now you can think of them as vectors, and you can be able to, you can manipulate them as vectors. And it will, you'll actually have a whole language for dealing with solutions of a differential equation that you lacked before you had linear algebra. Okay, where's my clicker? There it is. All right, so another thing we had in the context of the vector space Rn was the notion of functions that would take you from one Rn to another. We call those linear transformations if the functions would be compatible with scalar multiplication and vector addition. Well, by just changing these the domain and codomain from Rn and Rm to more abstract vector spaces, V and W, the same definition holds. And in fact, we can also define the range of a linear transformation and its kernel. The range, well, before, it was a set of vectors in the codomain that could be reached by applying your linear transformation. And that's exactly the same definition we'll use in now this context of a linear transformation between two general vector spaces. And the kernel, sorry, it went off screen here. The kernel is the same. It's this, it's the set of vectors in the domain that get mapped to the zero vector over here. And sorry, this is a typo as well. It should be the zero vector inside W. And but this, these are two subspaces that we can now attach to any linear transformation between two abstract vector spaces. Okay, so let me show you what these are good for in the context of a vector space of functions. Well, first of all, if you have a function for which you can take as many derivatives as you want, you're going to get an operator that's going to take you from differentiable functions to differentiable functions by simply differentiating. And what I want to point out is that action. When you take the derivative of a scalar multiple of a function, you just get the scalar multiple of the derivative of that function. And when you take the derivative of the sum of functions, you get a sum of the derivatives. That's just, you know, differentiation ignores constants and it distributes over addition of functions. Well, these two conditions tell you precisely that the act of taking a derivative is a linear transformation on the space of functions. Here are the two properties. We want to be able to multiply, do scalar multiplication either before or after we apply the derivative and get the same result. Well, that's compatibility with scalar multiplication. And here we could add two functions before or after we apply this derivative operation, and we're still going to get the same result. Well, that's compatibility with vector addition. And so this operation, taking a derivative, is going to take a function to a new function. Well, it's actually a linear transformation on this space of functions. And moreover, skipping a little bit ahead, not only is taking a single derivative a linear transformation, but if you take multiple derivatives, it's just like composing a linear transformation with another linear transformation. You get another linear transformation. So in fact, not only is dx or ddx, not only is that a linear transformation, but if you take arbitrarily high derivatives, it's still a linear transformation. And in fact, you can do things like take a function of x and take a higher derivative, and this thing is still going to act like a linear transformation on your space of functions. Okay, so why is this a, yeah?
Would, whenever we have an integral and there's multiple functions inside of that, distribute the integral, is that also a linear transform?
Yes, that's my next, what was my next example. I'll talk about Laplace transform, and you'll see that that's also a linear transformation. Okay, so if all these guys are linear transformations, well, we can ask, well, what is the range of a linear transformation? What is the kernel? In this context, the kernel is going to be more interesting. Suppose I construct a linear transformation that sends a function f, so a new linear transformation on the functions that we can differentiate. We'll send f to, x squared ddx squared plus x ddx plus, plus maybe 1, all have that apply to x. So suppose that's our linear transformation. My claim is that this guy is going to be seen to have the same properties, that I can do scalar multiplication or vector addition before or after I do this operation on a function, I'll get the same result. So suppose this is a linear transformation. Let's call it T. Then the kernel of T, remember this is defined, it's going to be the set of functions in your domain such that T applied to that function is going to equal the zero function, what I want to call it. I'll call it F zero inside C infinity of R. Well, here what I mean is the function that behaves like the vector zero in when C infinity of R is regarded as a vector space. But what this is it's actually it's going to be a set of functions f in C infinity of R such that x squared ddx squared plus x ddx plus 1 times f is equal to 0. And so the kernel of the linear transformation corresponding to this differential operator, well, its kernel is exactly the solution set of the differential equation that corresponds to this differential operator. And in fact, if you go on, if you've had linear algebra, this has been working in the background all the time. But if you go on to intermediate differential equations or partial differential equations, this point of view of regarding linear differential operators as being linear transformation, that's really important. And in fact, the whole apparatus of linear algebra is then brought to the forefront, the way you typically, well, for example, when you have a differential equation you can't solve by simple means. What do? You might try a power series method. What is the power series method? Well, it's just expanding it, your functions in terms of a basis of 1, x squared, x to the third, x to the fourth, and then trying to figure out what those coefficients are. So you're just trying to figure out how to get coordinates of a given function with respect to the standard basis consisting of functions 1, x, x squared, x to the third, et cetera. So all that apparatus that you were seeing purely in the context of differential equations, you can now see in fact, is an application of linear algebra to the setting of differential equations. And all you need for that to happen is to have this abstract vector space to work with. And then once you're in that setting, now all the linear algebraic apparatus comes into play. All right, and there was another example alluded to. Suppose I define a function L that's going to take me from, I'm going to say C infinity of R, although I should be more careful. I mean, what I need is, I don't even need C infinity of R. What I need are integrable functions, but I don't have good notation for that. C infinity with contact support, maybe, I don't know. Anyway, what I'm going to describe, just let's think of this as just going some nice class of functions to a nice class of functions. What it's going to do, it's going to take a function and it's going to produce a new function by integrating from 0 to infinity f of x, integrating against a decaying exponential function. And here we have a new parameter, and we use that for each value of this parameter s. We're going to get, when this is a number, this is just an integral of a function on the entire positive real axis, and I'll get a number out of this. So for each value of the parameter s, I'm going to get a particular number, and that gives me a function of the new parameter s. Turns out that this is effectively a linear transformation. It takes me from functions on the real line with variable x to a new function where now the underlying variable is s. And indeed, lambda, we take a Laplace transform to scalar multiple of a function, you're just going to get lambda times the scalar multiple, because if I replace f by lambda times f, I can just drag that constant through the integral sign, because integration ignores constants. And we're also going to have Laplace transform of a sum of functions that's going to equal the sum of their Laplace transforms. The reason for that is that when I replace f by a sum of functions, I can then integrate term by term. And then I'll see both terms are your basic Laplace transforms. So in fact, there's a whole lot of apparatus that you've been learning since you've been in college that is now being brought into this arena of linear algebra. One purpose of doing this transformation is to actually solve differential equations. And what you're doing is you're taking a given presentation of a function, you're transporting it into a better calculational setting, doing a calculation there. And then, of course, remember, in the hard part of differential equations, it's not doing the Laplace transform, but doing the inverse Laplace transform. But it's there. And although we don't necessarily use linear algebraic to calculate these Laplace transforms, it's certainly there in the background, playing an active role. Okay. Oh, let's see. So there's one other thing I wanted to say today. And by the way, today's lecture is kind of informal. Nothing that I say today's lecture is actually going to appear on the exam. However, what I'm hoping to do is to make the materials exam a little bit more palatable by giving you a wider context. I do want to warn you, though, is that when you think about a basis, don't think about Taylor expansions or maybe at the very end when you're looking for examples that give you some confidence that you're thinking about it the right way. Maybe that's the time to think about Taylor expansions or vibrational modes. The thing to remember while you're in this course is that, for the most part, vectors are just ordered lists of numbers. And even when we can now venture out to consider more general vector spaces, our goal is actually to transport whatever we're looking at into that calculable setting of Rn. And so, So the discussion today is just to show you how you're going to be using linear algebra once you leave the course. But while you're in this course, think of linear algebra and how it's been taught thus far. We're primarily interested in understanding how to work with ordered lists of numbers. All right, so let me talk a little bit about vector space isomorphisms. So what are they? They're linear transformations between vector spaces, but what we require is that they're invertible, meaning once I have a linear transformation that takes me from V to W, if it's an isomorphism, that means there's another linear transformation that will take me from W back to V, and it will have the property that it just reverses exactly what the original linear transformation does. So now I can now go from B to W, and I can go from W back to V. All right, so this notion of isomorphism is actually the real reason why all this apparatus of general vector spaces, how it actually works. So let me remind you that a function between two vector spaces, a function between two sets, it's going to have an inverse if and only if that function is injective and surjective, meaning surjectivity means that this map completely covers the codomain, and injective means that two points here get mapped to distinct points over here. If you have those two conditions, then you'll always have at least the existence of an inverse. You may not have it in your hand, but at least you know that the inverse exists. Well, in the linear algebraic context, those two properties, injectivity and surjectivity, well, they have they're equivalent to the following. Surjectivity, the ability to reach every point over here, that's equivalent to saying that the range of your linear transformation is actually equal to W. And that may be not something that's readily seen in these abstract vector spaces. And in fact, remember that when we had a vector space Rm and a vector space Rn, the range of that linear transformation just didn't pop out of thin air. Rather, what we had to do is find the matrix that was associated to this matrix and then find a basis for its column space, for example, to actually get a legitimate hands on what this subspace is. Well, that's going to stay the same. But if we want to show that we actually have an isomorphism, that we can go back and forth between two vector spaces, then what we need to show is that the subspace associated with the range of the linear transformation, that actually coincides with the codomain. And if the kernel of the linear transformation, the subspace of vectors in the domain that gets sent to the zero vector here, if that consists of only the zero vector, then in fact, we're guaranteed that this inverse transformation would exist. All right, so let me show you see if I can get through this point. I guess what I want to show you, I want to prove the following thing, and it's really simple, but it's the key to why bases are important, and that is the fact that every finite dimensional vector space is isomorphic to Rn. This is actually what's really crucial in the end. So suppose I have V an abstract vector space. And suppose I now have an isomorphism that takes me from V to Rn. Well, if it's an isomorphism, the inverse map is also going to exist, and I can go back and forth between this abstract vector space and Rn. And in fact, Everything, every linear algebraic question I can ask over here can be transported over here. You can calculate, get an answer, and then you can take your answer back to your original setting. That's what you do with linear algebra. And essential to this coordination process is, of course, the basis. So what I'm going to show you now is, as soon as you have a basis, you have a map that will take you from your abstract space to the calculational setting and back again. So suppose we have a basis for an abstract vector space. I'm going to show you, I'm going to write down explicitly the map that will take elements of V and give you vectors, ordered lists of numbers inside Rn. I'm going to give you a function between the abstract vector space and the concrete vector space by, using the fact that we have a basis, we always can expand vectors. Once we expand a vector, we have an identifiable list of coefficients. And of course, with a basis, you not only are guaranteed that you have such an expansion, but also that it's unique. There's only one choice of number, C1 through Cn, that will allow you in this fashion to represent a given vector. And so we can take our vectors and assign them coordinates. What I want to show you is that this function is an isomorphism. It's a linear transformation. I guess the first thing to point out is that I can reach every point in the codomain. So this function IB is taking me from abstract vectors to numerical vectors. The way it's doing it, I use the fact that if I have a basis, I always have an expansion. The coefficients in that expansion is unique, so I have a way of going from an abstract vector V to a list of numbers. So that's my map. V goes to its coefficients with respect to this expansion. Well, it's clear that I can reach every point in this codomain simply by adjusting the numbers C1 through Cn in over here, because every vector can be written this way. And so I can completely cover the vectors here by just changing these coefficients. And that tells me that the range of this function going from B to Rn, that its range is exactly equal to Rn. I can get any vector I want by using a suitable linear combination. All right, so that's, let's go back here. That's showing me, so here we're going from our abstract vector space to Rn. And what I've just argued that for this coordination map that goes, once you have a basis, you can go from B to the coordinates of vectors in B. What I've shown you is that, in fact, the range of this guy is exactly equal to the entire codomain. And if I can show also that the kernel of this linear transformation consists of only the zero vector, then I will have established that I have an isomorphism between these two vector spaces, and so I can go back and forth between them. Well, to do that, we just have to look at what's going on. Here we go. If we apply our linear transformation to an arbitrary vector and we get zero, well, the rule is what this linear transformation does is it just grabs the coefficients. So if this guy is going to get mapped to the zero vector, I'm going to need C1 to equal to zero. I'm going to need C2 is equal to zero, et cetera. So the only vector inside our abstract vector space that gets sent to the zero vector is the one where all the coefficients are equal to zero, and that's exactly the zero vector. So in other words, the kernel of this coordination map is exactly the zero vector in the domain, and so we've got the range is the entire codomain, the kernel, it consists of only the zero vector. Those are the two conditions that guarantee that this function between two vector spaces has an inverse. And so what that's shown you is that anytime you have a basis for a vector space, You have a way of coordinatizing it. And in fact, it's more or less unique. There's a unique way of going back and forth between your abstract vectors and their concrete numerical coordinates. Okay, so was there a question? Yeah.
So is IB a function that takes us from B to Rn? And is that a specific, is there only one function like that?
Yeah, yeah. So and the reason for the subscript B is because it does depend on that basis. So if you look at this map, see, we once we have these basis vectors, so that's contained in this set B. Once I have these guys, then this by definition of what a basis is, these coefficients have to be unique. So it does give me a function that takes an arbitrary vector and gives me a list of numbers. And what we've shown in on last series of slides was that this function between the abstract vector space and the concrete vector space is actually an isomorphism. And it's the existence of that isomorphism that allows us to do the calculations. We can take concepts in our abstract vector space, bring them over to the calculational setting, do the calculation, take the answer back. But it's flowing through that coordination map. And that coordination map doesn't exist until you have a basis. Okay? All right, so I'll stop here today. And on Friday, what we'll do is we'll review for the exam that will be on Monday.
Sir, so can you hear me, sir? Hi.
Oh, excuse me, I got someone. Yeah, are you talking to me?
Yes.
Yeah, what's your question?
So the exam will be on next Monday, I guess. Wanted to make sure.
That's right. The exam will be on Monday.
Okay, thank you very much, sir.
Okay. Bye-bye. I'm sorry, you had a question?
So is the homogeneous solution a kernel?
The null space? Yeah, the null space of the associated matrix is the same thing as the kernel of the linear transformation.
So is that like kind of
if you look at that posted lecture slide, there's an example where I solve the differential equation just using linear algebra. What I do is I take that linear transformation, I associate a matrix to it, and then I calculate the null space of that matrix. And then I'd have to take the answer there and map it back to functions. But you can solve differential equations using just matrices and these isomorphism maps. Yeah.
Did we ever prove that that a linear transformation is an isomorphism if range t is equal to?
Well, we did this before spring break, but when I was talking about linear transformation, yeah. That was bijectivity. There were two conditions. You had to completely cover the target set, and you had to make sure that two different points didn't land on the same point. Because if they landed on the same point, you wouldn't have a unique function backwards. So that's what that's doing. And then making sure that you completely cover the target set, that's making sure that you have a function so that when you do try to apply the invert function, everything has something where to go back to.
Okay.
Right? So if everything here results from being landing here, then you can always go back to some point here. And then the injectivity makes that, whatever preceded this point, makes it unique. And then you get the function that goes back and forth.
Okay.
What this the range was, it was a different way of saying that the image of your function is the entire codomain. And the the kernel equaling zero, that turned out to be equivalent to saying that two different vectors don't end up on the same spot.
So we set it up by first defining what surjective and injective is.
Yeah.
Then showing that the two conditions of the range and the kernel
are equivalent to those. But now they're.
And then we said the definition was if it's bijective, then it's isomorphic.
Then it's an isomorphism. And now I'm I want you to think of isomorphism means it's essentially the same vector space, but we have better coordinates when we think of it as being like Rn rather than in its original abstract setting.
Right.
So and what those isomorphisms do, it allows you to take the whole vector space and work with it here rather than in its original setting.
Will we be able to show examples of that are not as trivial as just like polynomials?
I'm not going to require you to prove any. This is supposed to be expository rather than, you know, a formal part of the course that you need to know how these proofs work. Now, I just want to show you what this is good for and what the language is good for.
My question is just if we could take a linear transformation that's not as trivial as, you know, a polynomial, and find the IV, the fourth.
That's usually the hard part. So, for example, in the context of differential equations, the way you get that basis, well, effectively, you have to find two independent solutions.
Right.
And then once you've got those, now you've got the basis and you have a way of talking about the whole solution set.
Right.
But your principal problem is to find that basis. That's always going to be the case. So even though it looks like, I can always take things into Rn and do my calculations. Yeah. Yes, provided you have a basis, and so that you really do have a function.
Okay.
So the basis gives you the way to coordinatize, and then the whole game of applying linear algebra comes into play. And now you can talk about your abstract set concretely.
IV is a coordinate, right?
IV is the coordinization map. See, what you have are I don't have anything up on the board anymore. I'm sorry, I'm running over.
Yeah.
I'll take this conversation outside.
Okay.